This is Sending Signals, a show about music and creativity. I'm your host, Matt Royal. Welcome to a special extended episode of the show. Our guests this month, Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull and Chris Porterfield of Field Report. Ian Anderson is best known as the leader and sole constant member of British band Jethro Tull. As well as providing lead vocals and being a multi-instrumentalist, you may already have an image in your head of him standing on one leg playing the flute, a look that has been described as deranged flamingo. The musical history of Jethro Tull is diverse. They started out as a blues rock band, but outgrew that pretty quickly, and branched out into prog and bucolic folk rock and hard rock, shifting 60 million albums in the process. And oddly somehow beating Metallica to the Grammy for the first ever Best Hard Rock / Metal Performance in 1989. I'm particularly partial to two of Tull's albums, the prog landmark Thick as a Brick from 1972, and 1978's wonderful folky Heavy Horses. I spoke to Ian ahead of two planned tours in 2020, one a more intimate night of conversation and stripped back performance, and a full band tour focusing on the prog years of the band. Here's my chat with Ian. So this has been recorded for a podcast. Is that okay?
Sure, whatever. I've got used to accounting for my own indiscretions. If I say something bad and you decide to transcribe it, that's my fault, not yours.
I'm sure that's not going to happen.
Well, it does from time to time, but we have to live with the consequences. And once in a while, I suppose in the 50 years of doing interviews, I've probably said a few things I regret.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it must be a pitfall when you're talking so much as well. It's part of your job to have to self-promote, and it must be daunting as well, having to talk that much, and the risk of saying something you're going to regret must be like a bit of a worry, I guess.
It's a bit like being on stage in front of an audience and improvising, that, you know, you do something a lot of times, and whilst part of you learns to appreciate that the bits that you do repeat, the bits that have become embedded in performance, they have a right to be there because they are the good bits. But at the same time, another part of you wants always to try and find something different to play or different to say if it's an interview. And so sometimes you find yourself stretching out, looking for something you haven't said before, and then embarking upon an unwise level of discourse on a topic that perhaps you shouldn't really be voicing an opinion about, because it's really none of your business, or you don't have the authority or the wisdom to address.
Let me ask you this. Do you consider yourself to be a happy person? Or is anxiety like an ongoing feature in your life?
I've always felt a bit guilty in that I don't get... I don't get depressed. I don't become unhappy. I have moments of anguish and moments of lack of self-belief and moments of self-loathing, for that matter. But they tend to last somewhere between 10 and 15 seconds at a time. And there's always something around to make me laugh, or something around to make me smile, or something around that will fill me with optimism and joy. It could be something as simple as the geometric beauty of a snowflake, or it could be, you know, the sight of a young animal playing in a field somewhere, unaware that somebody is going to eat it before too long. all of those things, you know, you can always find solace in moments of looking at the good things.
So you're heading out on tour, Ian Anderson on Jethro Tull. What format are these shows taking? It's part conversation, part performance, is that right?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's a little bit of a follow-on from something I did a few times, I think four or five tours, I think I did, or maybe it was just three, primarily in the USA back in the early part of the millennium when I did a series of concerts billed as Rubbing Elbows with Ian Anderson, which were, you know, fairly intimate venues with an audience that was, you know, was a ticket-buying audience. And they were promoted and advertised as commercial concerts, but usually in conjunction with local radio, who would be involved in helping me find a couple of local guests, you know, a musical guest, that people would be invited to submit their garage tapes or whatever. And sometimes, of course, the musical guest was somebody relatively well known, but most of the time it was just some totally unsung hero of the suburbs. And I would have to listen to, and the band would have to learn their song, and we would dutifully perform it as a compliant backing group, give them their moment in the sun. And for the most part, audiences were very supportive because it was a local person. It was a real story. And it was rather nice to be participating in that moment where somebody, you know, got to live their dream and get up on the stage and strut their stuff, even with the varying levels of musical and artistic success that come with taking that chance. But you know, it was a format that was a lot of fun, and it was wearing because it was extremely, I mean, every day was different. Every day working with a local radio personality, a DJ or whatever you might want to call that person, that was an unpredictable, because sometimes they were perfectly at ease and comfortable. They'd done their homework. Sometimes they came in and tried to be a risque radio DJ in the shape of, I suppose, imitating Howard Stern and all those rather contentious people. And that might work on radio. It doesn't work very well with an audience. You've really got to have them on your side if you're going to poke fun or be outrageous. So sometimes that was a little difficult. Sometimes the guests could be a little difficult because they'd be tongue-tied, or might have some local personality who was there to be interviewed by me, because it was a kind of a dual thing. It was somewhere between a talk show and a music performance, but there was plenty of music as well from me and the band. And that is indeed the general shape, I suppose, of what I'm doing in the UK, but without the guests, because in this case I think it's enough to fill the better part of 2 hours plus intermission with storytelling, anecdotal stuff, some video stuff, some visual imagery, and of course a whole bunch of songs illustrating different parts of my musical career and how I got into music, how I picked up the flute, it's all that stuff. I mean, it is incredibly self-indulgent. And frankly, at this point in my life, I'm not really interested in doing that sort of a thing, except that our keyboard player needs to have 6 weeks off work to work on a West End musical production that he's the writer and musical director of. So he has had to have time off this year. And I thought, well, how am I going to fill that space? It's not just for me. I mean, I can fill the space by, you know, going visiting 2022 cathedrals to see whether or not I can play there. I can do that, or I could go out and do something to employ at least a few of the band and crew to give them some income, rather than leaving them with a huge big hole in the annual diary. So I decided on the latter. But like everything else, once you get your head into it and you get behind it in creative spirit, then things come flooding in that start to make it, you know, interesting and a challenge, and hopefully for me and for the audience a bit of fun.
Which is interesting, because you're quite hands-on with the business side of the band. I know you sort of book the flights yourself and do the itineraries and all these sorts of things, and I'm guessing trying to marry something creative with a business must be tricky. But sometimes you might make a decision that's a business decision but that affects the creative direction. But actually, there's an upside to that, because it keeps you perhaps in the mind of like what a fan might want, or what actually might appeal to people. And I guess there's maybe an unexpected upside to sort of that wrestling you must have to deal with all the time.
Well, on the one hand, it is pure pragmatism that it is usually easier to get on and do these things and learn about them early in life, so that you cope with it as part of your daily routine. It's pragmatism, you know. It's just makes life simpler than having managers and tour managers and people who just will complicate your life and take away a lot of decision making, a lot of information from you. And from you meaning the band, a group of musicians. And it's been a long time since we directly employed either a manager or a tour manager, because the internet has made the latter pretty much entirely unnecessary through the ease of booking hotels, flights, and getting things done. And in terms of more creative management, you know, we did enjoy for the first few years a very fruitful and mutually beneficial relationship with Terry Ellis and Chris Wright, who were our agents and then managers, and then formed a record company, and Chrysalis Records was born, and you know, we were in at the outset of that, and you know, that was a very useful time. But you know, they and we were learning our respective skills together, and there was a level of crossover. You know, Terry and Chris became more involved in the music side of things. Their appreciation of music became deeper as a result of working with Jethro Tull 10 years after Procol Harum, and so on and so forth. And I, at any rate, also learnt a great deal from hanging on to their coattails a little bit in regard to business and management, and understanding the changing face of the record industry, because of course it was really changing from the late 60s onwards in a way that I think was to the benefit of artists and ultimately to the general public alike, because suddenly the music business was being run by people who actually loved music as opposed to loving fat cigars and lots of money.
Have you found it harder to be creative as you've gotten older? Is it harder or is it easier?
Well, it doesn't seem harder. I, in a way, you know, there's that old saying about, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And I'm absolutely at odds with that idea. I think old dogs learn tricks a lot better, a lot more quickly than a lot of young dogs do, because we've learned how to learn. It's the acquisition of the ability to draw information, to store it, to compare it, to utilize it, that's the great thing about being at school. It isn't necessarily learning that, you know, what happened in 1066 or 1966. These are not important details compared to the absorption of that process of learning. That's what school does for you. It teaches you how to learn, not necessarily the right things to learn. And again, you know, I am grateful to my once or twice a week lessons in religious instruction at school, not because of what they taught me, but because they set me thinking about issues to do with the religion and the spiritual world. It wasn't what it taught me; it was the fact that it gave me some degree of understanding of how to look at these things, how to draw upon information. And I only wish I'd been back then. It'd been as easy as asking Mr. Google or Mr. Wiki when I wanted to look up things that were difficult if you were stepping outside the world in which you were brought up. Not that we believe everything that Wikipedia tells us, but there's certainly plenty of stuff out there to try to weigh up the various shades of opinion and decide for yourself what represents the closest thing to the truth.
How do you avoid repeating yourself when you've made so much art in your lifetime? Have you got any techniques you use to avoid repeating yourself and falling into sort of creative cul-de-sacs?
Well, there are some things that, you know, I would say repeating yourself is a pretty good thing to do, because there's a lot of stuff out there that in your past that you have to accept. It is maybe amongst your best efforts, and not to repeat them, but to go back and revisit them and put another spin on it, you know, with perhaps the maturity of somebody 30, 40, even 50 years later, that sometimes in that sense, repeating yourself can be quite a positive thing, but you've obviously got to be a little on guard not to go out there and just try to clone earlier efforts and pretend that they're new. And that applies outside the world of music. It applies not only in all forms of arts and entertainment, but it also applies in day-to-day life for most people. You know, that repeating yourself endlessly and sticking with the same ritual is comforting for a lot of folks, but not necessarily the best thing for mind and spirit. You know, I think you do need to always feel you're finding new stuff, and the way you find new stuff is to try and be self-aware and not just to settle into this comfort zone. And musically speaking, of course, that's very easy to do because there are songs that you perform that you've performed for 30, 40, 50 years that, in a way, the question when it gets asked, do you ever get tired of playing? And then, you know, one of half a dozen pieces of music that I will be asked. And I always say, well, I don't get tired of them because it's a performance. And when I'm on stage, I'm putting myself into character when I sing those songs. So it's not just repetition. It's not remembering just the words or the music or the right notes to play. It's actually about changing your mindset. And I really do try, when I'm on stage, I try to put myself in the character of the singer-songwriter, which is not always me, because, of course, I'm not really so much an autobiographical writer. I tend to write through the eyes of other people rather than ask people simply to see it my way from a personal experience. There are lots and lots of people out there who do the I, me, heart on sleeve kind of songs far better than I would do it. That makes up far and away the bulk of popular songwriting. I tend to do the other stuff. I tend to be writing about things, writing about other people, writing about viewpoints. And if it touches upon issues of politics or religion or social issues, then fine. You've still got to make that somehow give it the authority of singing it in character. And that's what I do, aided by, in my mind, the visual images from which many of the songs I've written come from pictures. Having been interested in photography as a child, my photographic instincts are always to try and recall visual events in my life and to be able to summon those up and interpret them in songs or in music rather than as painterly subjects or indeed to rush out armed with a camera to take a picture, a real picture of the thing that I'm imagining or recalling. So, you know, our eyes are our cameras. We get used these days to traveling everywhere with a smartphone, and everybody is a photographer incessantly. But these days, I think we should remind ourselves, particularly the best camera. My best camera is my two eyes, and lying shortly, you know, close behind my brain, which is my hard drive,
yeah,
my solid state drive, which so far works most of the time. I think there are some things that perhaps in life we wish we could press the delete button and yeah, put them away forever, consign them to the waste bin, and double delete them. But you know, unfortunately, these things are always with you. But fortunately, on the other hand, as long as you do have some reasonable recall of events in your life, and it's a great place to go looking for old images, because a lot of them are tucked away in there, and frequently are the subjects of new songs.
Yeah. Well, listen, to finish, can I ask you some quick fire questions? So you can say, you can say yes or no. You can give like a very short answer. So I've got some quick fire questions. So have you ever fallen over playing the flute on one leg?
Several times. Unfortunately, at least a couple of times you'll find it on YouTube.
Wow. Okay, I'll have to look at that. Do you find forgiveness easy or difficult?
Most of the time, relatively easy. Yes, I'm. You know, there are certain Christian ethics we mentioned before that you know, I do find forgiveness something that I'm pretty good at. My wife perhaps having been brought up in the sterner world of Catholicism and convent educated, is a little less forgiving than I am.
Is Aqualung a concept album?
I never thought it was, no. It was a selection of songs, carefully dressed up with, you know, something to, in terms of artwork and imagery, to try and draw it together. But no, in my view, it was a bunch of songs, two or three of which happened to have some connection. Basically, you know, I think probably three songs that tended to hang together a little more. But the rest of it was all very, very varied and coming from very different places.
Okay, you played the Isle of Wight Festival of the Moody Blues. Did you and Ray Thomas ever have a flute battle backstage, like a flute off?
No, I knew of Ray Thomas only very vaguely. I was not a Moody Blues fan, and it was only a little much later on that I really became, I suppose, very respectful of the fact that he was there before me playing the flute, probably, you know, by a year or two. And the flute solo from Nights in White Satin is a very iconic piece, which I had said a few times, well, one day I hope I get to meet Justin Hayward and you know, get to play the flute solo in Nights in White Satin. And that came true, because he was he came to be a guest at Canterbury Cathedral in 2011. And, of course, we did Nights in White Satin, and I got to play flute. So it was, no, I never met Ray Thomas. I think he'd kind of, by the time I got more appreciative of the Moody Blues' place in rock history, I think he'd retired by then.
Yeah. All right. Well, just to finish, what's left on your musical bucket list?
Well, I have a few little things that are kind of projects that are ongoing, but in a way, it's almost like, it seems to me rather, I don't know, tempting fate a little bit to talk about them, but, you know, there are things, you know, visual things, a book of lyrics, which essentially is a musical thing, illustrated book of lyrics, which I've been working on and off for, must be a couple of years now, in terms of editing. I've pretty much edited all the lyrics. I have yet to go and get all the photographic material together for the illustrations. That, you know, that's one thing that's a project in stretching into the future, along with some, you know, new recordings, which I'm, whenever I manage to find the time, I carry on working on. And a musical bucket list doesn't really involve playing so much with other people, but it does involve paying homage to other people. I suppose there's a few of them that I might think, well, I kind of, in a way, think maybe I owe it to somebody to recognize their work by attempting my own reading of it or version of it. Other people might say, well, you actually owe it to them to stay well clear of it and don't sully their good names. But, you know, it's meant in a true tribute sense, and I suppose a musical bucket list would be, you know, along those lines. I think most of the musicians that I might want to get up and play with are probably long since dead, whether it's Greg Lake or J.S. Bach. It's not on the feasibility list.
Yeah. All right. Well, look after yourself, Ian. I hope the tour goes well, mate. Well, you've got two tours, haven't you?
We come in October. We have a production tour, which is the more progressive rock-oriented work of the repertoire, rather disingenuously described as the prog years, because the prog years began in, actually, they technically began with a song I wrote at the end of 1968 and then recorded in 69. So the prog years go from 69 until 2020, actually. But it's just meant really to talk about the selective elements of the repertoire over all those years that you would describe as the more adventurous bits of progressive rock that the name Jethro Tull is associated with. So that's October.
Yeah.
Kicks off in February. I mean, I've only got another 6 weeks or something to get all the video material and the show kind of written, recorded, all the production stuff, and then, of course, rehearsals with the band. So we have to prepare for that.
How much of Thick as a Brick are you playing on that tour? Because aside from Heavy Horses, that's my favourite album?
Oh, well, the thing with Thick as a Brick is we did the whole thing, I think, back in 2012. We did Thick as a Brick 1, followed by the whole of Thick as a Brick 2, the latter-day sequel. And so been there, done that in terms of a whole rendition. But now we usually play something like an 8-minute or 11-minute little section of about three parts of Thick as a Brick.
Yeah.
You can't. I mean, the thing is, in a concert, you've really got to be thinking carefully when you start picking too many songs that last more than 4 or 5 minutes, because it just reduces the options that you have, and you know that there are things you're going to have to leave out. So I have the extravagance of about three long pieces in the 2020 production shows. The rest of it I deliberately try and keep to being either slightly edited versions of or original arrangements of things that don't go on really for too much more than 4 minutes, because you know, three long songs that last for 8, 9, 10 minutes, I mean, you're using up half the show.
Yeah, but it's a prog show, Ian. That's like, it's an oxymoron.
Well, I know, but then, you know, that might be well within the orbit of delivering on the basis of billing. But on the other hand, I think it would be very, very disappointing to people who would say, yeah, but what about that one? And what about that one? And it would be disappointing to me, because when I made a list of the things that I considered were the more sort of progressive rock moments over the years, I mean, the list was actually at least three times more than I could fit into a concert. So, you know, I was having to be selective from the word go, and of course, there's stuff that we play in every show anyway, which you might well say was, I mean, Thick as a Brick is not always, but often, maybe the majority of the time, some section, you know, some little part of Thick as a Brick is part of the show, and then there are songs that are maybe not distinctly, you wouldn't call them prog. They might slip into being kind of progressive rock, but they are nonetheless not. They are the most identifiable in that genre, but it would be very difficult to imagine a Jethro Tull concert and not play Locomotive Breath or Aqualung. But they wouldn't be sitting in my definition of progressive rock, you know, near the top of the list for sure. But you know, as always, you're thinking about not only your own position, but, you know, how is it viewed by people who've dug deep into their pockets to find, you know, 30 or 40 quid to buy a ticket. You know, you really kind of have to think about not necessarily going out and pleasing them, all of the people, all of the time, which is impossible to do, but in general, you've got to give them a little bit of the attention to choice that that you have to make on their behalf when you're coming up with a set list. So I'm not by any means compliant. I'm most of the time pretty selfish about doing what I want to do. But a little bit of me says, come on, you know, you've got to be ease off a little bit, because people are going to want to hear that one.
Yeah.
And I mean, there is, for instance, a version of Living in the Past, which it definitely goes off into a proggy version. I mean, you know, bombastic sort of big dramatic bit, which concludes the song. It wasn't part of the original recording by any means, but, you know, to me that justifies it being within that selection. And of course, for a lot of people, particularly in Britain, you know, that's probably the first time they heard of Jethro Tull, you know, top of the pops, Living in the Past, number three in the British singles charts. I mean, it was a bit of a long shot to have a song in 5/4 time signature in the top 10. Only I think on one previous occasion, and not since has it been a top 10 hit. Of course, Dave Brubeck's Take Five being the first.
Yeah. Wow.
Anyway, good to talk to you.
Likewise,
and,
Ian. Have a great tour, mate. Look after yourself.
All right, cheers. All right. Bye-bye now. Bye.
You may not have heard of Field Report, but leader Chris Porterfield is one of my all-time favourite songwriters. Based in Milwaukee, Field Report have put out 3 albums. But this year, Chris is trying a new approach, releasing new standalone songs throughout the year. A bit of history. Before Field Report, Chris was once in a band with a pre-Bonnie there, Justin Vernon. And the early days of Field Report saw them land high-profile support slots with the likes of Counting Crows and Emmylou Harris. The band signed to an imprint of Universal for their third record, Summertime Songs. Sadly, the album sales were not sufficient enough to impress the accountants at Universal, and Chris finds himself a free agent, a status he seems to be wholeheartedly embracing, as you will hear. You may benefit from listening to a few songs before the interview. Can I recommend Power Rider and Enchantment from second album Marigolden, Blind Spot from third album Summertime Songs, and also recent single Puget Sound? These all become quite relevant to this feature. Power Rider deals with a couple trying to keep it together after the loss of their child, and I was curious whether Chris could have written that song now that he's a parent himself. Enchantment deals with a recovering alcoholic searching for a religious epiphany. Chris has been open about his past battles with alcohol, and we discuss recovery. Regarding Blind Spot, well, it's a great single, but Chris has been kind enough to let me share with you an exclusive acoustic version of this song. This version has previously only been available on a tour-only cassette, so this is a digital exclusive, so I'm super privileged and grateful to be able to share it with you. You'll be able to hear it after the interview, but you may want to hear the album version first. And finally, Puget Sound was the current single when we recorded this interview back in January, and we take a very deep dive into it. This is a really great interview, one of my favourites, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
Well, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good.
Excellent. I got the time zones right then.
Yeah, you did a great job, right on the nose. Well done. What time is it for you?
It's 7 in the evening here.
Oh, very good.
What's your day looking like? You got a day off?
My daughter is at the babysitter's today, so I've just been working on some new music and running some errands, and that's about it.
How old's your daughter?
She's 3.
Right. Is that difficult? Mm-hmm. Is that difficult or is it great?
I mean, I've never experienced a more disruptive force in my life. She's great. It's really great. I mean, it changes everything for sure. But, it's a pretty wonderful experience. It does get trickier to, find time to just sit and think about the universe. It's real good. But I'm also very grateful for babysitters too, so that I can get some work done.
So do you, this sounds like a really odd question, but do you know who I am? Because we've met a couple of times.
Yeah, we met. I remember you were in Boston.
I was. Yeah. It makes me sound really cool to say. So the last time we hung out was at Harvard.
Yep. Yeah. And then before that, it was in London, right? Was it the...
Yeah.
At the Islington show?
Is it was. I think that's that's the only time you've played London, isn't it?
I think that's true, yes.
So I think I might be the biggest Field Report fan in England.
Right on. Well, and taking into consideration miles traveled for Field Report gig, that puts you up in the running worldwide, I would say.
I mean, it is tricky being a fan over here. Like odd things, like there was a 7-inch that radio station put out,
mm-hmm.
and so like trying to get that, and there's like Day Trotter 12-inch,
sure,
and so I got this stuff, and I wonder like how many copies of that are in the country, and there's probably hardly any, you know.
Right. Right.
But it's weird because even with Summertime Songs, you couldn't really go into a record shop and buy that album over here.
Interesting.
Despite sort of you finally having a major label support for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. Things, you know, some of those logistical things sort of remain mysterious to me. And I feel bad about that. I wish there was a better way, for people to get the things that they want and are interested in.
Yeah. I mean, I got, fortunately Amazon had some copies of a record. So I got Summertime Songs. Okay. You know, it wasn't, But like,
okay,
in terms of its sort of just general availability, it wasn't the sort of record you'd go into like your local shop and pick up, you know? And sort of the tour again. So we talk about us meeting in Boston, but like, uh-huh. I'm so grateful that even though I saw like a half hour show and you were like opening up and it wasn't the best of circumstances to see you, you know, that was, I got to see the Summertime Songs tour because I happened to be able to go to the States, which doesn't happen very often. And
yeah,
that'll be my experience of seeing that tour, you know? So
sure.
I'm like, I'd imagine it probably wasn't a highlight of the tour for you, but like it was, it was my one Summertime Song show. So I will, you know, I treasure that, you know?
Man, that's really cool. Yeah. I mean, I would say we probably had a better performance somewhere than that on the tour. But man, that's really, really cool that, that you were there. That's amazing.
So is there anything you don't want to talk about?
No. Wow. Anything you're interested in talking about is fine with me.
Okay. So should we start with the present?
Sure.
So I figured, because you've started dropping new songs, so I had imagined that there was an album about to happen in like a couple of months.
Sure.
And then I discovered that actually you're intending to kind of drip songs out and then kind of collect them together, almost like a collection of poems or short stories.
Yeah.
Have I understood that correct?
Yeah, I think that is the plan. I think we've been working for the last year or so, and we've got sort of a small cache of work that's, in my opinion, ready to be shared. And then we're continuing to work on a pretty regular basis at the studio. And rather than do the thing where you disappear for a year or two and make a thing in secret, and then suddenly there's an announcement, and then a several month campaign, and then a several month tour, and then start all over again and disappear, I'm kind of disinterested in the idea of campaigns right now.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty very interested in connecting with people who are curious about the work in a sort of a more immediate, less arbiters, less gatekeepers between us. And if we've got music, I kind of just want to share it. And so, yeah, we're going to do it that way. But also, I still very much think in terms of albums, and that's how I prefer to consume music. And so I think once we've got a bunch of stuff that's kind of out there, then probably at the end of the year, yeah, we'll collect some things and sequence it like an album and print it physically and make that available for people who are interested in having that experience. But I don't want to put all of the effort on that part first and then, you know, everything else, like these connections then just get deferred and things get put off. And I'm pretty interested in just working on a regular basis rather than, yeah, campaigns, like a two or three year campaign cycle.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sounds great. I guess you've addressed my sort of concerns in the, I mean, I'm an albums guy.
Yeah.
So same. The concept of a new Field Report album coming out is exciting because you're consuming something larger and there might be thematic elements that run through it, and it's going to be sequenced in a certain way. And also I wonder if you're writing with an album in mind that maybe rounds out your writing, whereas if you felt that you were writing a single each time, that may influence the work as well. And so I'm kind of curious when you're not thinking about the framework of an album, how that affects the art itself though.
Right. Yeah. So I'm noticing that there are still very much themes and things running throughout the songs. And I think that happens just sort of as I work through my life and how I understand the world and my relationship with it. And so there are still a lot of connective threads between the songs. But for me, I've never felt so free, frankly, as to just be able to exist, discover a small little universe in one song and explore that without having to worry about how it necessarily fits in with an expectation of a record. At the same time, I'm curious, like, as somebody who, you know, follows what we get up to and loves records like I do, do you find the prospect of that sort of release, is that disappointing somehow? Does it demystify things? Is it less special if you already know most of the songs when the record comes out?
I guess if an album's coming out and I've already heard it all, then that it's less exciting to buy it. I'm still going to want a physical copy.
Mm-hmm.
And I worry that the sort of the overall kind of, not everything has to have gravitas, but like
a
song coming out can feel a bit slight.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worry about that sort of watering down the cumulative effect that you get from listening to a Field Report album.
Sure.
However,
yeah.
As long as the songs are strong, like, what does it matter, you know? And Breathe is growing on me, but Puget Sound I love.
Oh, great.
So, however, in a year's time, if I've heard Puget Sound 50 times, and I've heard whatever song drops in December 5 times, and then it sort of comes out pressed on a record, I guess the sequence will make me listen to it in a fresh way. I don't know, it's complex. I don't think there's not a right answer. This is different, and so try it, you know? Like, why not?
I think we're going to give it a try this year and see how it goes. I feel like, I feel that Summertime Songs was a pretty good album, and I liked how it was sequenced. I like how it sounded. I think I stand behind the songs.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like generally people like you, not included, but generally it wasn't really received or understood as a record. And I found that kind of disheartening. And I asked myself a lot of questions about why that might be. And if I was sort of just sticking with this arbitrary format that maybe isn't the most important thing. If people want to receive it, you know, a song at a time, I mean, I don't do it that way. But maybe we should explore that, and perhaps it could reach new people because it's easier to consume and it's less dense. But at the same time, I totally understand the argument that the experience therefore is less rich because there's not as much mystery to dive into and the sort of excitement of a whole new thing and finding your own space in the nooks and the crannies of it.
But there's two upsides over that are kind of obvious, though, in that because you're putting out a song at a time, I don't think there's filler on your albums anyway. I think that everything is extremely well thought out, down to like a single line or down to like a synth part being put through like an old THX system, or you know, your albums are crammed with detail and they're meticulous, so I don't think it's ever been a problem. But however, if you're going to put out songs individually, like, one benefit is that, you know, you're going to feel strongly that song can stand by itself, you know?
Right.
So that's got to be good for artistic level. Secondly, as a fan, I guess it is nice to have something new regularly rather than waiting 3 years for a new record.
Yeah.
Like, if every couple of months it's like, oh, there's a new Field Report song. That is quite nice.
Yeah. And there's so much going on musically and culturally and in the world today that it's very, very difficult to be top of mind, even with people who care a lot about your work. And so to disappear and then have to re-educate people two or three years later and get reacquainted and catch up on everything that's changed and, you know, oh, you know, we wrote this thing, but then everything has changed since then. But I guess here's the thing that was reflective of the headspace and the environment that I was in 2 years ago. You know, there's just something about the immediacy of it. And then honestly, like, this is strange, But I'm noticing that as we trickle out new pieces of work, each one gets progressively more attention, sort of just digitally, like streaming. And there's something about the algorithm or something. I don't know what it is, but like you kind of have to tease it a little bit, and then people, you know, the diehard people find it first, and then suddenly, oh, it gets on a playlist. And then the next one, like based on, I don't know what it is, man, but more people see it faster when you put things out one at a time. It's very weird. Huh. And I'm trying not to be cynical about it. I'm mostly just curious about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, like with each little release so far, like we've seen quantifiably more people are hearing it.
I don't know if you can tell me this or if you want to tell me this, but I wonder how many Summertime Songs is an album. How many did it sell? Do you know, or can you tell me, or would you rather?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. That was, you know, that we made that record how we wanted to make it, and then suddenly we had the opportunity to sell it to Verve, which is part of the Universal record system, and so that involved way more people and way more guardians and gatekeepers than we've ever experienced before. So I honestly have no idea how many units were moved. I do know that it wasn't nearly enough to keep the accountants happy.
Huh. Do you know if it was your best-selling album?
I don't know.
No.
I doubt it, but I don't know.
Did Marigolden sell more than The Thirst?
I don't know that either.
Yeah.
Yeah, I honestly don't. I'm not aware of the numbers on that. I know that just now, within the last 6 months or so, we've finally sold enough to have recouped the advance on both of those records with the label.
Okay.
And so now, for the first time since 2012, I'm actually seeing a little bit of money from that.
Wow. So do you have to maintain a day job, or are you making enough from playing shows and from revenue streams?
Yeah, no, I don't have a day job. We're justifying that at the moment by looking at the expense of childcare, full-time regular childcare, and it's worth more for me to be available at home most days than it is to try to go out and find work. My daughter will be in school beginning next year. And so then my value becomes more fungible and negotiable to my household. But my hope is that, you know, that means I'm free then to go out and work more. And so I don't know. I can make probably about as much as a teacher, you know, if I really work hard. In a year, barring anything surprising.
Work hard at music or something else?
Music, yes. Yeah. Continuing to sort of develop the lens that is Field Report, and then, you know, use that to sort of understand the world around me.
I heard you say that you could have told the label that Summertime Songs was not going to sell 100,000 copies. But to me, that makes... I don't know. I don't think you could, and I don't think anyone knows, because I don't think you would have predicted that first Bon Iver record would sell as much as it did. I don't think you could predict that Lost in a Dream by the War on Drugs would sell what it did. You know, when in a world where the national... and the War on Drugs are playing the London O2 Arena.
Right.
That's not a world where Field Report can't sell a ton of records, because to me, as a fan, I don't see much difference. I think of you as kind of contemporaries with those albums and those guys. I know on some level there's a difference because of I got to see you play in a back room of a pub in London. But in terms of like the standards of records and how they fit, you know, or even like, why are you not selling, you know, why are you not on the level of like Nada Surf or Mid Lake or the Hold Steady? You know, it's
sure.
just there's
yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me at all.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that either. I would love to have some uncertainty reduced in that area. But you know, you're not alone. I think that was why Universal was interested in working with us, because they did hear something in the music and in the spirit of it that was sort of consonant with some of those larger selling bands. So yeah, that whole experience, I mean, I learned a lot about how those things work when you involve a lot of people and suddenly there's a budget. And some of it was cool and a lot of it I didn't really care for. And so when the accountants started pressuring the A&R people, who we had a really good relationship with, to say, it's time to get out of the field report business. And we were having conversations with the A&R people about sort of what that was. It was pretty clear to me that I wasn't interested in being in that kind of relationship again, where everything creative was sort of being second guessed. And like, are we aiming at the right thing where everybody wants? What are the expectations? You know, all this thing. And so I ended up starting a label with the producer and engineer who did Summertime Songs, Daniel Holter. And that's just going to be the home for everything I do for the foreseeable future. And that certainly doesn't have the same reach that a major worldwide label has, but I've never felt so unafraid and so sort of relieved to not be responsible or accountable to anybody but ourselves.
So I guess you still have an agent for touring.
Yeah.
You still have you still have a PR company to do the PR stuff.
Yeah.
So does that mean that, say, at the end of the year, you decide to put a piece of vinyl together with the best songs you put out in a year? Does that mean you have to look for a distribution deal?
I think we would just do it ourselves, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've got – so part of the reason that working with – my friend Daniel is compelling is he's had a commercial licensing music company for the last 25 years. And so digitally he's, you know, distributed worldwide and has all that infrastructure is already built out, which is very convenient. And also we're allowing him to rep the new work in his licensing capacity. And we're already seeing more bites on that than we did with the traditional sort of licensing thing. Rather than wait around for the Super Bowl commercial that's not going to come, or the, you know, the World Cup or whatever, where everything is just sort of fast-tracked. And so that's part of, you know, sort of this idea of a middle-class living to keep food on the table and also to keep it viable to do the work. So, yeah, I guess ultimately, as far as vinyl, we would probably just press it ourselves and make it available online.
Yeah.
And you can buy it there. Not going to worry about stocking record stores, you know, all over the place. That's just sort of a direct to consumer thing that if you would like it, we would like to make it for you, but we're not going to sort of spray the world with it. It's going to be a pretty limited edition probably.
Yeah. This kind of makes me just feel like you're not coming back to the UK, are you?
Well, no, I really do want to get back. I really, really do. I'm talking to some people who get over there more regularly, and I'm pretty interested in supporting them on some tour this year. I really, really do want to get back. So another part of it too is making peace with the idea that a lot of people who like my work actually prefer it solo. That's not necessarily how I prefer it, no. But it's certainly a viable way to do it and to do it a lot simpler.
Yeah.
And so I imagine that I will actually be over sometime this year in a solo capacity.
Okay. I mean, I think you said that because you've kind of re-recorded Summertime Songs, haven't you? Because you don't own the masters for that record.
Correct.
But you own the songs,
yep.
Mm-hmm. And you sort of indicated that there's a section of your fan base that kind of prefers the stripped down versions.
Mm-hmm.
I like the record, you know, I personally like you making a record. You know, it's like
I like making records. Yeah. I prefer that.
There's two songs unaccounted for still, isn't there, from the two EPs? Did you record those, or did you just record the 8 out of the 10?
No, we did record those. I wasn't crazy with how they came out, and I didn't want to labor over it. But yeah, there's a solo version of Blind Spot that's kind of like sort of a Whiskey Town version in the guitar. Nice. Which is it's okay. I'll send it to you. How about that?
Great. Well, I was good. This might be seen as a massive liberty, but if you want to put it on the podcast as a way of it being out.
Oh, okay.
I'd love to do that, but
sure, we could do that.
Only if you're happy to do that, I'd love it. But
sure, yeah, that'd be fine.
Yeah,
that'd be fine. Yeah, and then what's the other one that's not? Oh, Everything I Need wasn't on there.
I feel like that needs the arrangement. You know,
I agree. It just didn't translate well on its own.
If our health should leave us, if your rescuers don't see a section, you know, mm-hmm. you need that.
Yeah, it needs to be supported. Crescendo. It needs to be. Yep, I agree.
Can we dive into Puget Sound?
Sure.
You did a thing for a radio station when Marigolden came out, where you broke down every song almost line by line. Do you remember doing this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. That was with then a Milwaukee radio host named Kaleo, and that was kind of how he and I became friends, because spent like a very long time in the studio together. And he's since gone on to become the producer and host of World Cafe, which I'm not sure if that program has an awareness where you are, but is one of the bigger sort of
Well, I tell you, so World Cafe is the sort of thing you would see on like B-sides and stuff. So there might be like, I don't know, Ben Folds 5 CD single might have a B-side that was live at World Cafe.
Elbow
recorded an EP live at World Cafe, so I was aware of it. And then the trip when I went to Boston a couple of years back, we went to Philadelphia for 2 nights.
Oh, great.
And I got to go to a World Cafe show on Friday lunchtime. And it was amazing, because it's full of sort of retired people. there was literally a couple that had a giant patchwork quilt that they'd been getting signed by artists for like years. And they'd like, it was such a surreal experience, and it was really beautiful. And we saw it was a double header, and there was a folk band called Twisted Pine.
Okay.
And there was a blues rock guy called Gary Sovey. It was a Gary Sovey band. So, and yeah, it was like a free lunchtime show. And yeah, we had just the best time going, you know. It was really
That's
cool.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. Yeah. So World Cafe is a sort of a program and an institution part of, the public radio station in Philadelphia.
And
it was kind of, they've really developed a passionate, dedicated audience, and they've trained them well, where the leisure class and the pensioners are all there on their lunch breaks to go see some live music. It's really cool.
So you did the interview with him for Marigolden, is how we got onto that, wasn't it? Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. He's now there in Philadelphia, sort of heading that up. But before that, he was in Milwaukee, and that's who he and I were the ones we talked together about track by track Marigolden. Yes.
And that interview, so I guess I heard it on SoundCloud. I think it was streaming or something. You must have tweeted a link at the time. And so I heard that, I think, before I physically had a copy of the album. And it made such a difference to how I heard the album, you know. It's just, there's so much that I might have missed, like details, like you mention a place called Truth or Consequence in Enchantment, and like, unless, I mean, it doesn't necessarily make a difference whether you enjoy the song or not, but knowing that that was a real town that changed their name so that they could have the honor of hosting the game show there,
right?
You know, that short-sighted decision for a cheap thrill, you know,
right,
and the long-term
right.
consequences of that. Just that little detail just makes, and that's just sort of a couple of lines in one verse, you know,
uh-huh.
and it made such a difference to how I received the album. And it just made me think that, like, all artists should be able to,
huh.
it doesn't work for uh-huh. everyone, but like, when the work warrants it, for an artist to be able to sort of explain what they meant makes so much
yeah.
difference to how it's understood and how much stuff just gets missed on like a shallow
sure.
first listen, you know?
Uh-huh. Well, that's cool that conversation could unlock some of the work for you.
And so I kind of wanted to do something similar, but for the new single.
Sure.
So you put out the sort of press release that it deals with sort of themes of isolation. Straight away, I don't, as an English guy, I don't know what Puget Sound means.
Sure.
What should I take from the title straight away?
So Puget Sound is a body of water. It is, it's off Seattle, the city of Seattle, Washington,
yeah.
is located on Puget Sound.
Huh.
So it's like a big sort of bay or harbor that connects with the Pacific Ocean.
Okay. So is the character in the song visiting Puget Sound from essentially where perhaps you live now?
Yeah, the opening line is, I've been landlocked so long, implying that, you know, sort of away from water or the mystery or the power of it, that when you actually get to it, you don't even know how to begin to understand it or to experience it in a way that doesn't seem like almost like a movie or something. You know, you ever have that feeling where like you're in your life, but you see it like as a scene from a movie or something, and it somehow cheapens it because it sort of demystifies the whole thing.
Huh. So he mentions sank on the horizon, doesn't know how to call it, looks like it's coming aground. Do you have a sense mm-hmm. of what he's actually seeing?
You know, okay, so I wrote this song. I was in the midst of a long solo tour. It was a 6-week solo tour. When we were in Seattle, we had a couple of days off. And so I found on Airbnb this Airstream trailer, which is a little sort of camper kind of thing that was right on the water about 30 miles south of Seattle. And so I just posted up there for a few days and just did nothing but write and walk around. And this song came out of that stay.
Yeah. So then you're surrounded by a kind of grass. I can't work out what type of grass it is. When I was listening earlier, is there a specific?
Eelgrass. Yeah. I guess that's a native plant to that area. It's just like a seaweed, basically.
Yeah.
Seaweed on the shore. Mm-hmm.
So then you've got sort of beach ephemera, slipping stones,
mm-hmm.
beach glass, bird bones.
Mm-hmm.
And something starts pushing through my skin. And so you have this metaphor about growing roots, wings, dripping poison from my fangs. So it's like you're metamorphosizing into something figuratively.
Yeah, I think so. Just sort of feeling a change coming on and not knowing if you can trust it or not. Yeah, I think the whole thing, the narrator, which is kind of me and kind of not, as they all are, is really a pretty untrustworthy individual. And you're not sure what their motives are.
As in that they're an unreliable narrator or in that they can't
yeah.
be trusted as a person?
I would say both.
Okay.
I would say both.
It's all happening again. Incredibly ambiguous line. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Is the lyric different on the first chorus? Do you say, but I get found out on the first lyric, or is it always drowned out?
I think it's always drowned out, but there was a lot of last minute editing that went through just about to the finish line of that song. I changed the chorus entirely. It was a very dynamic record process. And so I don't, I think it's always drowned out. but there was a period where it was found out.
Right. Okay. Just the second were like more distinct, and then the first chorus, I wasn't sure if it was drowned out if you changed it. So.
Oh, that's interesting.
Every chord washing back on Puget Sound.
Uh huh.
Can you tell me what it means?
I think it's just, you know, I think this person is just feeling very misunderstood.
Yeah.
And the fact of that is sort of compounding this sort of paranoid energy around the whole situation, and being misunderstood and also being isolated is just sort of a feedback loop of I guess paranoia. I don't know.
So early you had the line, "It's all happening again." And then mm-hmm. again, we get this similar sentiment. It was the first time in a while.
Mm-hmm.
It was the worst timing. I got nobody here I can call.
Yeah, I think sometimes when we experience, you know, any event, positive, negative, whatever, we frame it in a way that it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And then after the end, it's on to the next thing. Yeah. But actually, it never ends. Nothing ever ends. You're always in the middle of it. You never get through to the other side where you'll never have to deal with anything again. It's always just a constant negotiation, navigation, triangulation, and you just kind of have to shift your weight and balance. And I think that is part of this narrator's experience.
Yeah. So then, hope I can find a ride. I can feel the water rising. Meet up with the sky as it falls. I like this. Is your city sinking? Okay, so it's like, yeah, is the water coming up or is it the city going down? And then it's like,
yeah,
what does
right.
it matter who blinked first? It's like, it doesn't. What difference does it make?
Right. There's no sense in trying to explain it. Like, this is the experience. This is the current reality. So that's just where we're at, I guess. Is it your fault? Is it my fault? Is it the fault of the circumstance? It's whatever. Here it is.
I wondered if, can you call it your own without taking everything coerced by a horrible thirst? Is that, I wondered if that was to do with like feeling displaced, like whether you can call a city your own, like what does it take for somewhere to be home?
Yeah, no, I think you're on the right track. Yeah, and also, what does it mean when somebody calls a place full of millions of people their own? Like, what kind of person has that sort of ego to even conceive of the idea of owning something that involves so many others? Like, you almost have to be some degree of a narcissist or something to even make that claim, or just so unaware that you could make the claim and then not think about it farther. Like, what are the implications of that?
So can I might tell the truth? Is that the line, or have I misheard?
Can the night tell the truth?
Right. Sorry. Okay. That makes more sense.
Yeah.
I was trying to transcribe it earlier through, cause I couldn't find the lyrics online and I was like,
sure.
I'm going to transcribe this quick. And I was doing it.
Oh,
you've done a very good job.
You've done a very good job.
So can the night tell the truth? Do you trust the moon smiling while it lies to you?
Yeah. I don't know. I think I was just really doubling and tripling down on sort of the imagery of the water and the scene, and the tide and the moon and all of it. And the idea of not only the narrator being untrustworthy, but things that you've always understood and known to be true being untrustworthy.
If I'm using you, I hope you're using me.
Yeah, that's sort of a glossed over awareness that this person is not being the most generous, and then trying to justify it by flipping it, almost gaslighting whoever he's talking to. Like, well, you're doing it too.
And then find a kinder tide to pull you where you need to be. It's a beautiful image. Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you. It's a kind of a mouthful to spit out, but I loved how kind and tide. I love how those sound together.
Yeah.
And it just, it sounds like, I don't know. It sounds like waves, just kind of, I don't know. I liked how it felt.
There's, it's interesting, just digress a second. Sometimes the feel of the words, together in your lyrics, like even on an old song, like I'm Not Waiting Anymore, you know, the keen-eyed observer of the movements of concentric parts, of bodies of bones and breasts and unmapped chambers of hearts. It's like, it's kind of wordy, but it's really satisfying to try and get your mouth around it, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. That's my instinct. For a while, I tried to fight it, but then I realized it's just how I do it, and I think it makes the performance and sort of the owning of the songs sort of pretty specific. Like that song, for example, "I'm Not Waiting Anymore." That a version of that appeared on a record by the Blind Boys of Alabama.
Huh.
And they could not get their mouths around the phrasing of all that stuff. And then they had Sam Amadon come in and sing the verses, and still, like, it just didn't make any sense. And so changed a bunch of lyrics around for them, and they did it. And it's a cool record. You should check it out sometime.
Right.
It's wild to hear the context of that song in a totally different context. But the point of that being, like, yeah, I know my thing is, it can be pretty specific.
Yeah. So the final verse, my time is spilling out. It's almost like it's being held in. It's almost like sand being held in a hand or something, you know?
Yeah.
It reminded me of what's the song that's got the lyric about sand? The sand has turned to glass.
Oh yeah, that's also "I'm Not Waiting Anymore." That's a later verse of that song.
Ah, okay, yeah. Reminds me of that a little bit.
Sure.
I've got too much to keep. I'll try you again in a couple of weeks.
I think part of that verse is about being somewhere and reaching out to somebody who's supposed to be there, but them not able to find the time to be there with you. And so a little bit of resentment creeping in, a little bit of whatever, but then saying, well, I'll try again. I'll see if the time for us to connect is still in the future, or if that's just sort of a completely lost cause, yeah. I guess.
And then I feel like the close of this thematically reminds me of like a Springsteen song or something, because it's I'm holding on to all of this because there's nowhere I can set it down until the tide recedes. That kind of idea of having to carry stuff inside of you because you just you're holding on to things that you can't let go of, you know?
Right. Yeah. I think there's something in the narrator's mind that maybe we don't have access to. Yeah. And I think almost they know that it's, they know it shouldn't be bothering them anymore. There's a bit of shame involved, I think, in whatever's happening in the subtext. And then that last line is just sort of by way of explanation, like, you know, I wish this wasn't a thing, but it is.
Do you have a more rounded, like, I guess it's a usual thing that the songwriter doesn't, their interpretation of their own song isn't necessarily more valid than a listener's interpretation.
Right.
Do you have a more rounded version of this in your head?
No, I think you know, kind of what we talked about right now is kind of how I understand it, at least from sort of a narrative perspective. It always changes. The meaning always is a slippery thing when it's performed. When any song is performed, for me, it always changes on me. It's a pretty magical opportunity for me to check in with the work and with myself to perform it anytime. But no, I think what we've discussed here is pretty much how I understand a song to be. I think there is an element to it that is a bit mysterious or a bit less
defined.
Less defined. But I think that was sort of an aesthetic choice too, just to sort of reflect that it's sort of this whole metaphor of a massive expanse of constantly moving water that you're trying to find yourself in the midst of.
I remember you saying that when you toured the first album, someone came up to you after the show and basically talked to you as if you were an alcoholic.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, right.
And that it just, because you were at the time,
uh-huh,
and it
right.
just floored you, that you'd left the breadcrumbs there in the songs and basically hadn't realized.
Yeah.
Did that put your guard up in terms of writing in the future? Did you start to worry what you might accidentally reveal?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think I've always been pretty interested in, if not fully sharing, at least being vulnerable or having something exposed where somebody could find it relatable.
Yeah. You then sort of, I mean, it's interesting because then you addressed the sort of overcoming the drinking problem. It kind of became a theme of Marigold and to a degree, like Ambrosia deals with it like really
right
head on.
And yep, there's
one of my favorite lyrics is in, again, it's the truth or consequences part of Enchantment, where it's cashed in my 30-day chip for a kiss. It didn't taste like I remembered it. It's
right
one of the most heartbreaking lines on the record.
Oh, thanks.
Was that born from having experienced a relapse, or was it just an imagined scenario?
Yeah, no, and you know, I'm not much in my life is tied off super cleanly. Yeah, there's been falls and climbs. Yeah, and even on that record where it was so much about sort of overcoming, yeah, that came from an autobiographical place, falling off the wagon and sort of being so compelled to get back into it. And then when you squander everything that you've worked so hard for, suddenly it's not even nearly what you thought it was going to be.
I had Steve Ferroni from the Heartbreakers came on the show.
Huh, cool.
And he had got himself into a very bad place. And I think he's been sober for like quite a long time now, like considerable time, but he still does sort of AA meetings every day. He speaks to another alcoholic. He takes it incredibly seriously. And I sort of said, is it still like this far down the line? Is it still like a realistic possibility you could relapse again? And he feels that it is, because he's seen it happen to others, you know?
Right.
And are you at the stage where you don't drink at all, or do you, or can you enjoy a drink in moderation now? Have you had to totally stop?
Yeah, I mean, I did have to totally stop for several years. I'm in a position right now where I guess I'm sort of poking the bear. I'll allow myself a glass of wine occasionally.
Yeah,
I don't drink on my own. I don't drink anything other than wine or a beer. I don't have more than one. And I don't do it if I'm driving anywhere or working. So I've got those sort of parameters around it. And I'm telling myself that then within those parameters, it's okay. But I recognize that that line of thinking is actually a very addict line of thinking. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm still pretty aware of the problems that my relationship with alcohol created, and I've got some accountability. My wife is aware of it. I'm not hiding it or sneaking it.
Yeah.
And she checks in with me. I don't go to I'm not a part of any organized program at the moment. I don't know. I mean, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly glad you're healthy now, you know.
Yeah,
well, you'd indicated that you'd got somewhat depressed last year, and I wondered if that happens, if that's a particularly kind of dangerous situation for you in terms of things escalating again.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, I think substances are just a way to cope with sadness and depression. It's a way to feel or not feel in a different way. Yeah, I got dark for a while. I think a lot of it honestly had to do with some of this professional stuff that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
And feeling pressure to make things a certain way in order to appease the powers that be, and then having the powers that be decide that even in spite of that, you know, you're back on your own. And that, and also I sort of intentionally took last year off from performing just to spend time at home. But I found out about halfway through the year that I need that opportunity to perform. And the absence of that really ate me up, like in a very real way. Like, not doing that was very unhealthy for me. Huh. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, started going to therapy. It's been amazing. I recommend it wholeheartedly. If you can find someone who can help objectively see things from 30,000 feet. And yeah, I'm on some antidepressants now. That's definitely helping out. Yeah, it was kind of a gnarly year, but I'm feeling pretty optimistic at the moment.
Yeah. Just I want to ask you one last thing. Do you think you could have written Power Rider now that you're a parent?
No. No, I don't. And in fact, I have personally felt conflicted about that song, just because I did, you know, now that I am a parent, I don't feel like I deserved to be able to write that. But I have had people reach out and say that it has been helpful, and that they have felt somewhat heard and understood through that work. And that is a deep mystery to me that I will never understand. But I don't think I could have written that now.
Huh. I mean, I love the song, and I don't have kids. I've never lost a kid, so I can't. I've got no frame of reference for how it would feel, or it's totally imagined. And so, yeah, I guess. But for you, when you wrote it, it was imagined as well. And so I wondered how having a kid, if then just the concept became so real that it would actually be you couldn't, maybe you can't write about it if you have a kid. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, perhaps. I think having had the experiences that I have had now, if I would have tried to do that, I would have said things completely differently. To me, some of the ways that I said things in that song just seem a bit gauche, a bit coarse. And so I hear it reflecting back at me and say, oh, that, you know, what right does that person have to try to discuss that experience? But there's another song that I haven't recorded, but I have tried to play out a few times, and it's about I don't know if you saw over there, but the United States Mexico border, there's a lot of conversation and more about immigration and people coming in to the United States from other places.
Yeah, well, I listened to This American Life, and so that's gone into stuff. And
sure,
oddly enough, there's a track on the last Bon Iver album kind of inspired by that situation. There's a song Exploder episode.
Sure, it, right. Yeah, because they recorded, the place where they recorded a lot of that was right on the border.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a photo that a journalist published. I don't remember. It's probably 8 or 9 months ago now. But it was an image of a father and a daughter. And they had tried to cross a river into the United States, and they both drowned. And their bodies washed up on the shore. And, the daughter was literally tucked into the shirt of the father, like he was not going to let her go. And so I sometimes when I don't know what to do with something, a song will come. And I did write a song, and I question myself, just like in Pale Rider, like, what right do I have? But ultimately, I feel like the story needs to be told, because the point of all of this is human connection and understanding and empathy and imagination. So yeah, there's a song that I've written that have not yet recorded called Oscar y Valeria. And the father's name was Oscar, and the 2-year-old daughter's name was Valeria. I've tried to play it a couple times and I've literally just broken down weeping on the stage. And so I'm not quite sure what to do with it. But yeah, that's another one, kind of like Pale Rider.
But I mean, how much art wouldn't exist if everyone restricted what they created to from right. their own realm of experience?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
There'd be no science fiction for starters, you know?
And
I guess it's just difficult when it's heavier subjects because you know that there are people that have gone through stuff and so you want to represent them. You don't want to offend them and you don't want to represent them in a fair way.
There's a sensitivity and, you know, an obligation to not be cavalier. You can be cavalier with your own experiences, but somebody else's suffering is something that I feel like I need to be really careful with.
This has been great, mate. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad we could finally connect.
Yeah. All right. Take care, mate.
Thanks, you too.
All right, buddy. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
And now, as promised, the alternate version of Blind Spot.
Blind Spot, take three.
I woke up blacked out in a snowstorm with an airbag burning on my cheek. Check the wreckage, walk away, okay. I'm gonna change. I'm swerving to and plowing through the trees. But you're in my blind spot. 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 My heart is a cold cave. My mind is a parking lot. And your voice came like a frost quake on the plains. And this old body is a closet filled with hoarded nothings. My soul is a cathedral in an air raid, and you were in my blind spot. You were in my blind spot. You were in my blind spot. You were in my blind. You see the trouble with flying, it's the gluing on of feathers. Then there's a body just laying at your feet, still faithfully yours, unchanged, unhinged. Oh, you did not ask to be, but you're in my blind spot. You're in my blind spot. You're in my blind spot. You were in my blind. You were in my blind spot. You were in my blind spot. Blind spot. You were in my blind spot.
That's our show. Thanks as always to our guests, whose opinions are their own, and And thanks this week also to Sharon Chevin and Matt Bolton. Bye.